Hey there, Misfits. This is Kate.
And this is Kevin.
Welcome to Horrorwood. A new Patronian today. Yes. Am I very loud? I feel kind of loud.
I you sound okay to me.
Okay. Well, the thing's not in the red, so I guess it's all right.
Oh.
I feel like I haven't been here in a while.
We did do like a kind of a
It was
almost like a
2 week
without recording.
Yeah, because I was gone and the schedule's crazy now. So, yeah. But here we are.
We're back.
Yes, we have a new Patronian, a new Misfit Murderino.
Oh, my goodness.
Josie. Josie, thank you so much.
Oh, my God. Josie, thank you. Is it Josie of Josie and the Pussycats?
Oh, my God. Is it? Tell us.
I love that movie so much. Josie, do you like that movie? Tell us. Okay.
We hope that you like the bonus episodes. Yeah. We hope that you like not having to listen to ads. We have more bonus episodes coming your way. So thank you so much for signing up. And I was telling Kevin before we started recording, so my sister's family gave us this little plastic goat that screams. I think we need to incorporate it.
We need to do it.
Into the show.
I agree.
And I also feel like he needs a name. So maybe we poll.
Let's poll the Patronians.
Let's do it.
Okay.
And see what his name shall be.
Maybe we use it to beep words out when we curse.
Maybe. Although it would just be
screaming throughout the entire thing. That reminds me of like that, the goat sound from the Taylor Swift video that was like, I think it's off Red, where it's like, where she goes, oh, but they replaced it with that goat scream.
So here's what I love about what Kevin just said. When he walked in today, he gave a 5-minute dissertation on how his roommate is obsessed with Taylor Swift and how he is not, likes her, thinks she's an amazing
artist.
She's
great.
But he is not, he doesn't have the obsession that his roommate does.
I'm not an obsessed super fan.
And the fact that he just voluntarily
brought up Taylor Swift,
began talking and knew the album that was off
of. Oh, no. I'm secretly like obsessed. I'm like, Kate, and I like turn around. I have like a tattoo of Taylor Swift.
Amazing. I went to a Taylor Swift brunch today.
Oh, I love it.
It was part of Matt's birthday because Matt is a Swiftie and he's proud of it. And you know what? I mean, I think I am too. I'm in my Swiftie era.
Can I bring Spencer over and maybe he and Matt talk about it?
Maybe they can talk about it.
So they don't have to fucking talk to us about it.
I don't mind it.
I do.
No, Swiftie brunch was so fun. And they went around and they handed out friendship bracelets. And everything was Taylor Swift themed. And they played Taylor Swift music the whole time. And it was super fun. And Matt loved it.
That's amazing. Was there a Taylor Swift drag queen?
That's the one thing it was missing.
Damn. Missed opportunity.
All right, then.
Okay. Leave a review.
Yeah.
4 stars out of 5.
Could have been 5.
Where was this Taylor Swift drag queen?
Well, as much as I enjoy this banter,
yes.
I have a really horrific case today.
You said that.
And it's pretty awful because it does involve a murder. Or, well, okay. 2 murders. Oh. Well,
you're like 3 murders.
It actually is 3 murders,
oh,
depending on how you look at it. So.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh.
So let's get into it. It's a bit of a rough one. And I do go into all the details that are available and that are out there. I do mention the Asheville Citizen Times, which is a local newspaper to the area that we're going to talk about. They had great articles on this. So I've linked a couple, but there is a character limit on Apple and all of that. So I don't know that they'll all show up. Mm-hmm. But if you click on one, you can get to all the other ones. And then there was also a great series on YouTube called A Good Kid. Mm-hmm. And I'll link that as well. That actually is about a different case. But there's one episode in there pertaining to what we're going to talk about today.
Is Asheville in North Carolina?
It is.
Okay.
On March 18th, 2015, filming began on the movie The Big Short in New Orleans. Christy Codd, a celebrity chef who owned her own catering company and worked primarily as a caterer for TV and film productions, she'd been hired as the caterer on the set of The Big Short. At the time, she and her husband, JT Codd, who was scheduled to begin working that same week on a production in Los Angeles, actually, they were living in North Carolina. They had moved there fairly recently from Los Angeles, and I'll talk more about that and their careers in a bit.
Okay.
But Christy was excited about The Big Short, not only because the film starred some pretty big A-listers, Ryan Gosling, Brad Pitt, Steve Carell, and Christian Bale, but she had spent a lot of time in New Orleans. She had family there. Plus, it also gave her an opportunity to visit her parents, who lived in Biloxi, Mississippi, which is where Christy grew up.
Anytime anyone says Mississippi to me, I remember, like, from school, I spell it in my head rather than saying Mississippi. I go M-I-S-S-I-S-S-I-P-P-I.
Ours was M-I crooked letter I, crooked letter I, humpback, humpback I.
Well.
Anyone else?
How did you learn how to spell Mississippi? Tell us in the comments. I apologize. Continue.
On Sunday, March 15th, 2015, 3 days prior to when The Big Short was to begin filming, Bill Schoen, Christy's dad, was expecting his daughter to arrive around 4 p.m. for a visit. Bill hadn't heard from Christy in a few days, which was highly unusual, especially since she was going to visit him. Like, she would at the very least have been like, hey, I'm on my way, I'll see you soon, but he hadn't heard anything. As 4 p.m. neared and he still hadn't heard from her, he knew something wasn't right.
Oh, no.
He called Cecilia Owens, who lived in Leicester, North Carolina, and was Christy and JT's neighbor. She often house sat and dog sat for the couple whenever they had to go out of town, and she had keys to their place, so Bill asked her if she could just pop on over there and check on them.
Yeah.
Cecilia went over to the Codds and noticed their cars are in the driveway, so she was like, well, they must be here, but no one answered the door. She used her key to get in and immediately knew something was wrong because the
smell.
Well, the smell was awful because there were two dogs that had been left there that had urinated
and pooped.
Yeah, they had shit everywhere.
And pissed everywhere. Were they alive?
They were alive.
Oh, okay,
yes.
Good.
Cecilia said that those dogs were Christy's babies and she would never just go off and leave them. And it appeared the dogs had been alone for a while just because of all of the urine and shit that was everywhere. Christy always kept things immaculate, so this wasn't sitting well with Cecilia. She worried that the couple might be hurt or really sick, so she went through the house looking for them, but no one was
there. They weren't there. Ooh, that's weird.
But Christy's purse was there.
Oh.
And so was JT's wallet.
Okay.
Which aren't great signs.
No.
And a medicine cabinet had been left open with some Band-Aids taken out. Things were just in a bit of disarray.
Were cars there? Did they have cars?
Their cars were there, too.
Yeah. Shit.
Cecilia called back Bill Schoen and told him something's not right here. Mm-hmm. And remember, he's in Biloxi.
Mm-hmm.
And his daughter lived in Leicester,
North Carolina. Okay.
Which they are not close. So he contacted the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office and asked them to do a wellness check at Christy and JT's home.
Oh, good. Okay.
Of course, when officers arrived, Christy and JT were nowhere to be found.
Right.
Christy's parents drove all night to Leicester just in the hopes of finding their daughter and son-in-law. Officers contacted JT's parents, and they said they also hadn't heard from the couple in several days. Detectives immediately began treating this as a missing persons case, which, good for them. I was really surprised because I feel like in almost every other case where we cover someone over the age of 18,
they're like, oh, they are adults. They can go wherever they want and not have to tell anyone about
it. Exactly.
I fucking hate that.
So for these detectives to label this a missing persons case from the beginning is impressive. Because,
good on them.
Yeah, it doesn't always happen that quickly.
Listen to people.
Exactly.
People.
And it didn't take long for detectives to find them.
Okay.
They actually weren't that far from their home.
No.
But tragically, both were deceased.
No.
So what happened to Christy and JT Codd? Before we answer that, let's look at who they were.
Hmm.
Christy Schoen was born on September 3rd, 1976 in Madrid, Spain, to her parents, Bill and Betty. Are those not the cutest names for parents ever?
Bill and Betty. Were they on vacation in Madrid?
No, actually, her parents were in the military.
Oh, got it.
Yep. So Bill was in the U.S. Air Force. They traveled all over the world, but primarily Christy grew up in Biloxi. Her dad was a big cook, which is how she developed her love of cooking. And as a kid, her parents were working a lot, which meant she and her two brothers were often responsible for preparing their own meals.
Okay.
It's kind of like, sorry, kids, you're on your own. Yeah. Figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where she really started experimenting with different foods, different ingredients, and really developed her love of cooking. Being raised in Biloxi, she was especially drawn to Southern cuisine and more specifically, Cajun cuisine.
Oh, fuck. Give me some Cajun foods.
Her nickname became Cajun. So her coworkers would be like, what's on the menu today, Cajun?
Cajun.
Which is really cute.
I had the best food when I went to New Orleans. I dream about it. The shrimps and the food. I can't think of what I had. I'm sorry. Shrimp po' boy.
I'm so
enamored by it.
I went to New Orleans when I was 12. And so it's been a minute. And I remember the jambalaya, delicious, and I remember the beignets.
Beignets.
And, oh my goodness.
Yeah. I had a muffalato sandwich, which is like this bit, so good. And then my favorite thing was like shrimp and grits, cheese grits. It was in this like brown gravy with a biscuit in the middle. It was literally
delicious.
The best thing I've ever eaten.
Do you think about it and wish you could go back there?
I dream about it.
I have that with food. It's like there are places where I'm like, where I know I'm probably never going to be back in that place.
No.
I'm just like, I just want that dish.
Yeah. I remember the waitress was like, you ordered the right thing. And I was like, thank you.
As a single tear rolls down your cheek.
I had like gravy all over my shirt as I left, like crying.
As much as Christy liked cooking,
she
loved performing. She attended LSU where she double majored in performing arts and German. She even studied abroad in Germany, where she fell in love with European cuisine. So with growing up in a military family, moving around a lot, and with all the traveling she did, she really had a well-rounded knowledge of different cultures and different cuisines.
Did you ever study any languages? I don't know if we talked
Spanish.
About this. You studied Spanish?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I studied Spanish in high school, and then I did I took like 3 or 4 semesters of German in college when I first started.
I've never studied German, but on my own, I tried to learn Japanese.
Ooh.
It was really hard. Although she loved cooking, Christy wasn't trying to pursue a culinary career. She actually wanted to be an actress. After college, she moved to New York, where she studied with the Atlantic Theater Company and performed in several plays there.
Wow, that's big deal, yeah. Like one of the top, I feel like one of the top-notch theaters in New York, outside of Broadway.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
From there, it was out to Hollywood. She worked as an extra and a stand-in and got a few small roles in TV and film. And she even did stunt work and was a stunt double for Kate Bosworth at one point.
In what movie?
Shoot. I didn't write it down.
That's okay.
But it was her chefing skills that really started to shape her career path.
Uh-huh.
I think she was beginning to realize that her passion for cooking and feeding people outweighed her desire to be an actress. She began cooking for TV shows and movies, eventually becoming a head caterer with her own catering company.
That's amazing.
When you're an actor or crew member working on a show or a movie, it's long hours.
Yeah.
A typical workday could be 12, 14 hours long, even longer sometimes. So obviously you're eating probably 2 of your meals for the day on the job. We had a little catering talk in last week's show about the Titanic chowder.
I was going to say, she wouldn't have put PCP in her chowder.
She would not have. So staying on theme, I'm going to do a little more catering talk here.
I love it.
Productions will hire a catering company to feed all those people for the duration of the shoot. And we're talking anywhere from dozens to hundreds of people a day that have to eat. Everyone from A-list celebrities to the director to the camera and lighting crew to the background actors. The caterer is a huge job. You have to be such a good planner because you've got to plan those meals each day. You have to take into consideration different dietary needs. It's a lot. I think set caterers are so underrated. Christie started as a chef for films like Mona Lisa Smile and The Stepford Wives, and once she became a head caterer with her own company, she worked on Ender's Game, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Get On Up, and a few others.
When you're a caterer, mm-hmm. who is it the art? Do you have your own company which the production company contracts you, or are you part of a production company?
You have your own company, like with your catering thing.
That
and
they contract yes, you for. Okay, yes. Got it. I see.
And it was while she worked. Sorry, I was pulling my foot.
That's okay. My stomach, like, roar.
Oh, I didn't even hear it. And it was while she worked on sets that she met and befriended J.T. Codd. J.T. grew up in Gaithersburg, Maryland, and according to his sister Heather, he did not have an easy childhood.
Oh, no.
She says there was, quote, a lot of pain and a lot of suffering, but she doesn't elaborate, so I'm not sure what exactly his situation was growing up. But rather than that experience making him bitter and resentful, he was someone who was extremely compassionate and aww. Empathetic. And I say extremely because he made a lot of effort to look after those less fortunate and to offer help wherever and whenever he could. When he moved out to Venice Beach near LA, he'd invite homeless people into his house so that they could take a shower. And he even lived homeless for a while just for the experience, which, wow, I could not do that.
I know. I don't think I'd necessarily want to do that.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't want to. When he started working in the entertainment industry, he wouldn't think twice about hiring people who had served time in prison. Lynn Michelle, who grew up with JT, said he was, quote, non-judgmental with a helping hand. He really took everybody under his wing who other people weren't willing to give a second look to. JT worked as a key grip for films and TV shows. The grip department is in charge of setting up all of the rigging for the camera. So, like, if the shot is a big overhead shot where the camera's mounted onto a crane so that it can capture the footage from above actors' heads, the grips are the ones setting up that support system for the crane shot, like making sure the camera's secured, making sure the DP, which is director of photography, the cinematographer, the cameraman, essentially, making sure that that person is safe, that sort of thing.
Good to know. I've actually always, when I sit through credits, I'm like, I wonder what that person does, like yeah. the key grips.
Yeah.
Now we know.
Now we know. They're really important when it comes to safety on set.
Oh, wow. Well, I'd imagine, like, yeah. if you're dealing with the camera equipment.
Exactly. And so there's also, like, dolly shots where the camera is mounted onto a track, kind of like
it's
a
moving.
Yes.
Okay.
So they're the ones laying that track and setting all that up. So when you see, like, those hundreds of names that come up in credits, and then you start to learn, like, what all of those jobs are. It really is kind of impressive to know, like, how many different moving parts there are in a production.
Mm-hmm. Literally. Like, we just said moving, you know.
Yeah, I got it.
And my mic just moved.
It sure did. Like, it's all coming full
Kismet.
Circle. So a key grip, which is what JT was, mm-hmm. is the head honcho of the grip department.
Got it.
So he's head grip, Christie's head caterer. The two of them are at the top of their professions.
I love that. I imagine like a love story called The Grip and the Caterer.
I don't think we have to imagine. Actually, I'm going to talk about it. They started out as just friends. Christie was dating a guy named Dirk Long. They lived together in a small one-bedroom apartment that didn't even have a kitchen. So she set up a grill outside, and according to Dirk, Christie cooked for anyone and everyone that walked by and wanted a meal, including homeless people.
I was going to say, and the homeless?
Yep.
They're good people.
Very compatible.
I love it. I just imagine, like, they're on set after a work day, and, like, she feeds him a piece of Cajun food, and he's like, delicious. And then he's like pushing her on the tracks where the camera is. And she's like, wee.
I don't think that's exactly what happened, but probably something pretty similar.
I think so.
Christie was really open and just wanted to share her passion and talent for cooking with anyone that might appreciate it. So she and JT were very similar in that they opened their hearts up to everyone. Christie's friend, Stephen Supper, said, quote, she was all about a sense of community, bringing people together and making people feel welcome. She could be tough, too, though, oh. and wasn't the kind of person you'd want to do wrong. She didn't want people to mistake her kindness for weakness, which I think is pretty much every woman
out there. I was just going to say.
And every man, too. I don't think anyone wants to be considered weak.
Well, I think people take advantage of kind people.
Yes.
Easily.
100%.
If you're kind and you don't know how to put up a barrier, it can be hard, mm-hmm. right? It's that people-pleasing tendency.
Yeah. Christy was really outdoorsy. She liked hunting and fishing and dreamed of one day opening her own farm-to-table cafe. JT, when he wasn't working, loved to travel and went backpacking through places like Costa Rica and Nicaragua. As Christy and JT's friendship grew, it became clear to them that they shared so many interests and values and were about as compatible as two people could possibly get. They began dating. In 2012, Christy was selected to compete on the 8th season of the cooking show Food Network Star. She was on Alton Brown's team. Alton said of her, quote, "I see hope in Christy. She's passionate. She knows she has a message. Blah. She's past. Blah." I'm going to try it again. Alton said of her, quote, "I see hope in Christy. She's passionate. She knows she has a message she wants to get out."
Okay.
I had a hard time getting that message out.
You did it. Woo. And then the goat screams.
In Christy's casting interview for Food Network Star, she said, "I still have a lot to learn, but I'm open. Bring it on. I'm excited about it."
Oh, it's already been rotten.
She dreamed of having her own cooking show called Homegrown with Christy Schoen. I'd watch
Stop
it based
it.
On the title alone, which yeah, I did not mean for that to rhyme too.
That's an amazing title, though.
I love
Homegrown
it.
Homegrown with Christy Schoen.
Love it.
I imagine like outdoors, bell jars, lemons, Cajun lobsters.
Oh, I'm hungry.
Me too.
I'm excited. Unfortunately, she was eliminated from Food Network Star in the first round.
Fuck them.
But she responded by saying, "I just have to be positive and keep going after what I want to do in my life." The relationship between Christy and JT was getting more serious, and they were starting to think towards the future. They knew they wanted to build a life together, get married, have kids, the whole nine yards. But they didn't envision raising a family in LA. They instead settled on a place on the other side of the country in rural Lester, North Carolina, just outside of Asheville. I've never been, but I was looking at pictures and it is beautiful.
Is Asheville on the west or east side of the state, though?
No idea.
Don't know. I'm actually, keep talking. I'm going to look it up on my
okay.
phone. Because I'm curious.
Several films have been shot in and around Asheville. Dirty Dancing, The Fugitive, The Hunger Games, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Love that movie. There's a lot more, but that's just to give you an idea. And there's a movie coming out next month called Summer Camp that stars Kathy Bates, Eugene Levy, Diane Keaton, and a bunch of others. It's got a lot of big names in it that was also shot in this area that we're talking about. Some of Christy and JT's LA colleagues were like, "Really? You want to move there? It's in the middle of nowhere." Because it was the complete opposite of LA. But that's kind of why they loved it.
Yeah. I mean, and they want to start a family.
Yeah.
And like, obviously, like, people can have families in cities, of course, but like,
sure,
you know,
LA is a hustle and bustle, and it is a strong vibe, strong flavor out there.
Ooh.
But in this area that they were falling in love with, there were huge oak trees and fruit trees and a fresh water spring. It was in the Blue Ridge Mountains. It's really beautiful. So Christy and JT bought a small, modest home on 36 acres of land. They wanted to create a self-sustaining aquaponics farm, and Christy eventually hoped to open a farm-to-table restaurant.
What's aquaponics?
It's where you raise fish and plants, and the water from the fish feeds and purifies the plants and vice versa. It's like
an ecosystem.
Kind of an ecosystem based with fish and plants. Fish and plants.
I love that. Another title of their love story.
Fish and plants.
Fish and plants.
They weren't giving up their Hollywood careers, though. They were established enough that they didn't need to live in LA to book jobs. And since a lot of things shoot on location anyway, oftentimes they'd be traveling regardless of their home address.
That's smart.
Yeah.
Like, you can, that's a career where you can, you know, kind of live anywhere and
Absolutely.
Then go to where you need to.
And sometimes they'd be gone for months at a
sure.
time, which made having a quiet, serene place to come home to all the more enticing.
Yes.
It's really the ideal situation. They get to do the job they love, mm-hmm. travel all over, and then have this quiet mountain home to relax in.
With the fish feeding the plants and the plants
feeding the
them.
Fish.
God damn.
According to WLOS News 13, a local news station in Asheville, and they're the ones who have this series on YouTube that I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, The Codds also purchased a property with a friend that they planned to renovate and flip. JT was looking for contractors to not only help with work at that property, but also to do odd jobs around his home. And that's when he found a local handyman named Robert Jason Owens, who went by his middle name Jason. Owens was out of work at the time, and in true JT fashion, he wanted to give the guy a chance, let him make some money, so he hired him. Owens lived just about a mile down the road from the Codds, so that was convenient. Owens cleared trees on the property, he built a well house for the couple, and he must have done good work because they kept hiring him.
Oh, good.
The Codds even gave him around $7,000 to help with his handyman business. They also gave him a key to their storage shed and tools, which doesn't seem that weird to me. Like, in one article
You're
I read...
handyman.
Yeah, in one article I read, it was like, oh, they, you know, they trusted him enough to give their key, but he's probably having to use those tools pretty often.
He probably doesn't have his own tools yet, either, if he's just building his business.
Yeah, so that didn't, like, really strike me as odd or anything.
Sure.
Eventually, Owens regarded the couple as his friends. On Christie's Facebook page, she has a couple of videos that have him in it. One is him operating a large tractor, like a backhoe, to dig up dirt. Another video is of him and Christie talking, and she's showing a project he's working on. It's the well house. And she has him describe what it is, how they need to maintain it. And then she says, thanks, Jay. And he's very soft-spoken and just seems kind of quiet. But there does seem to be a friendliness between them, especially the way she calls him Jay. He was even a guest at JT and Christie's wedding. They married in the fall of 2014, and friends of the bride and groom noticed Owens in particular because to them, he didn't seem like someone that would be hanging out with JT and Christie. Their friend Michael Mendez said, quote, there was a gut feeling when I looked at this guy and I avoided him. This was one person I definitely did not want to meet. James Fernandez, he was a set decorator in Hollywood and a friend of the couple, said that after the wedding, the Codds had a bonfire on their property, and James sees Owens kneel down and then grab another man by his feet and tackle him to the ground. So James ran over and said, hey, this isn't that kind of party, at which point Owens tried to punch James.
Ew.
James pushed him down and held him there until Owens' friend came over and got Owens up and walked him off the property. Afterwards, James told JT what had happened, and JT just kind of shrugged it off. He was like, oh, they work for me. Things happen. And the guy that he was tackling was apparently a friend of Owens. I think they both worked for JT. So, yeah, he was like, they're just, you know, messing around. Like, it's not a big deal. Because, again, JT was always willing to give a person a second chance and always willing to help someone out who was down on their luck. This was one of the rare points of contention between JT and Christie. Because rumor had gotten around that, hey, you need some money? Go see JT Codd. You looking for work? See if JT Codd has something for you. So strangers were always coming up to their home. One guy came up trying to sell JT an assault rifle because he needed money. Another guy came up to the house asking money for gas, so JT told him he'd fill up his tank for him. This kind of thing kept happening, which really began to alarm Christie. Her thinking was, you're crazy, you can't keep giving out money because people are just going to keep coming up here wanting more. You never know what might happen. But JT's response to that was that he didn't care about the money, they had it to give, and that you can't live in fear. If you can help a person out, do it. So that was his sort of way of looking at life. Having all these people coming to the house, though, made Christie scared to be there alone, which is sad because this was supposed to be their haven. And Christie and JT had just found out they were pregnant with a baby girl that they decided to name Skylar due the following July. So she's also thinking about her unborn child and doesn't want anything happening that could put her baby in danger.
Yeah.
She actually kept three guns at the house to feel as though she had some protection. And she was right to be alarmed because just a few months prior, in August of 2014, JT reported a break-in at the property along with about $5,000 worth of power tools being stolen.
Eek.
Jason Owens' name was listed on a report related to that case, but it's unclear if he was considered a suspect or just someone police had talked to since he worked for them. And unfortunately, police never figured out who had stolen the tools. Jason Owens didn't seem like one of those people Christie would need protection from. He'd done so much work for them over a decent amount of time. There was definitely a familiarity there. And he was a solid worker. He did work all over town, and over, everyone said he was a good worker, did a great job. And anyone who's had an extensive project done on their home, there's a certain level of trust mm-hmm. that you have to establish because these people are in your personal space.
Yeah.
When Matt and I moved into this place, like there were things that weren't done yet and still needed a lot of work. And it felt like these guys practically lived here. I mean, they were here every day for weeks because, you know, it takes these projects take forever. And yeah. you do start to feel like you know your contractors.
Mm-hmm.
But how well can you really know a person?
Mm-hmm.
JT and Christy were still relatively new to the area, but even people who had lived there for years didn't know all the details about Jason Owens' past. Owens had lived in Lester his entire life. He was born in 1978 to his mother, Betsy, yet no name was given for his father on his birth certificate. So it sounds like he was out of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
Those who grew up with him said he was always clean cut, very personable and respectful, very much the boy next door. He didn't really stand out in a good or a bad way. He was just your average kid. It was while he was in high school or just shortly after that he got into doing handiwork. And those that hired him said the same thing over and over. He was quiet, he was a diligent worker, and he didn't cause any trouble. He was a pleasant person to be around.
Hmm.
However, in 1999, he had his first of many run-ins with the law when he got his first DWI. Then in January of 2000, when Owens was 21, I believe, his friend, 18-year-old Zeb Quinn, mentioned to him that he was looking to buy a new car. And Owens told him he happened to know one for sale in Lester. On the evening of Sunday, January 2nd, around 9 p.m., Zeb clocked out of his job at Walmart and met Owens in the parking lot. The two drove separately to the location of the car for sale.
Yep.
Around 9:15, they can be seen on surveillance footage inside a gas station buying sodas. Zeb Quinn was never seen alive again. The next day, Zeb's mom filed a missing persons report, and the day after that, a man claiming to be Zeb Quinn called Walmart where he worked. The supervisor answered, and this man on the phone said he wouldn't be able to come into work that day because he was sick.
Hmm.
But the supervisor didn't recognize the voice and knew it wasn't Zeb.
Yeah.
So she star 69'd the call. Remember when star 69 was a thing?
I do.
If you dial star 69, it redials the last number that called you.
Yeah.
So when this Walmart supervisor did this, she was connected with the company Volvo Construction Equipment, where Jason Owens was an employee. Police questioned Owens.
Okay.
Owens said that after he and Zeb had left the gas station that Sunday evening, Zeb flashed his lights, signaling Owens to pull over because he'd gotten a page that he needed to return. Owens said when Zeb returned from the payphone, he was frantic and told his friend he had to cancel their plans. As he sped away, though, he rear-ended Owens' truck and promised to pay for the damage. Hours later, Owens was in an urgent care center being treated for a head injury and fractured ribs, which he said he got from a second car accident that night.
Hmm.
That's a pretty unlucky night you're having if you get in two car accidents and end up in urgent care.
Hmm.
But no accident report was ever filed.
Sounding sketchy.
Regarding the call in sick to Walmart, Owens told police that Zeb had called him and asked him to call in sick for him, which makes no sense because if you're going to call in sick, just call in sick. You're not going to call your friend to say call in sick. So didn't really make a whole lot of sense what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And after making his statement, Owens stopped cooperating with police. 2 weeks later, Zeb's car turned up in the parking lot of a barbecue restaurant next to a hospital where two of Zeb's relatives worked. Strange, but even stranger was what police found inside the car. First off, the headlights had been left on. On the back window in pink lipstick, someone had drawn a pair of lips with an exclamation mark. And this was not a small drawing, like it takes up pretty much the entire back window. Inside, they found a hotel room key, but they weren't able to trace it to any hotel. There were several drink bottles and a jacket that did not belong to Zeb, and a live black Labrador mix puppy.
What?
We don't know where the dog came from or how long it had been in that car. One of the investigators ended up adopting it.
Good.
Owens was always a prime suspect in the case, but they just couldn't find enough evidence against him. There are more details to the Zeb Quinn case, but I'm just giving you the key points here. Mm-hmm. Other shows and podcasts have covered that case. You can definitely find out more about it, and it'll come up again later in this episode. Okay. In 2002, an officer attempted to pull Owens over because he suspected he was driving drunk, but Owens didn't stop and instead led the officer on a high-speed chase in which he drove more than 120 miles per hour before hitting a mailbox and flipping his truck.
Whoa.
He pleaded guilty to eluding arrest and served 8 months in prison.
Yeah.
In 2007, investigators obtained a warrant to search Owens' property for human remains in connection to the Zeb Quinn case, but they didn't turn up anything. Later that same year, Owens was involved in yet another high-speed chase, this time with North Carolina state troopers while driving with a revoked license. Other charges he's faced through the years include attempting to distribute controlled prescription drugs in both North and South Carolina, possessing stolen goods, assault on an officer, and drunk and disorderly conduct. Between 2002 and 2009, he spent about 23 months in state prison.
Wow.
That's according to the North Carolina Department of Public Safety.
Okay.
According to his former sister-in-law, Carrie Smith, who stayed close with Owens even after divorcing his brother, she says that all those legal troubles came about after Zeb Quinn's disappearance, but that 1999 DWI would not be included in that. She said police had harassed him about what had happened to Zeb, and it really weighed on him, and he'd always been a loving person and had never shown any signs of hurting a fly, much less a person. And Zeb was his close friend. She said he had always been a big brother figure to her and that he was a doting uncle to her son. He would take him fishing, just an all-around sweet guy, which is how a lot of residents in the area saw him. I think many, including the Codds, were unaware of his past legal troubles. On Wednesday, March 11th, 2015, that friend who was in business with Christy and JT to flip the house sent a text to JT at 5:15 p.m., but he never received a reply, which was unusual. The following day at 12:15 p.m., he texted JT and Christy asking, "Are you guys okay?" At 2:51 p.m., he received a response from Christy's phone that read, "Sorry, we both have this stomach flu, throwing up and such. We both have just been trying to sleep it off." This friend said the text didn't sound like Christy. It wasn't her phraseology, and he felt it was someone else sending the text. Days went by with no one hearing from the couple, which brings us to where we began this episode. When Bill Schoen hadn't heard from his daughter, who was supposed to be visiting him on Sunday the 15th, he knew something wasn't right. After hearing from Cecilia Owens, who happens to be Jason Owens' aunt by marriage, that the dogs had been left in the house, Bill called the sheriff's office to do a wellness check. When officers went to the home, they found evidence of suspicious activity and immediately began putting up crime scene tape around the property. The activity being the place was in disarray, the dogs had been abandoned, something wasn't right. They worked quickly to obtain search warrants for the Codds' property and their cell phone records to see if they could find any clues as to their whereabouts. That Sunday evening, upon learning of the couple's disappearance, James Fernandez, that set decorator who had seen Owens tackle that guy at the bonfire after the wedding, he called detectives in Buncombe County and told them about that confrontation. He just had a feeling in his gut that he couldn't shake.
Wow.
That same evening, an anonymous tipster called the sheriff's department and said they had seen Owens dumping a large bag or bags into a dumpster in Candler, which is about 10 miles from the Codds' home, and that it seemed suspicious.
Yeah.
When detectives went to check it out, they found several items belonging to Christy, including her ID, jewelry, a pillowcase and bedsheets, and a Glock handgun. In all, it was about $1,500 worth of items. On Monday, March 16th, detectives went to Owens' home to have a little chat. Just a little conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And he admitted that he had stolen some items from the Codds and taken it to that dumpster. Why are you going to steal stuff and then just throw it away?
Yeah.
So it didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
They arrested him on breaking and entering and larceny. Detectives then spoke with Owens' wife, now ex-wife, and she told them that he had told her he'd been driving JT's truck when he accidentally hit and killed JT. He didn't mention anything to her about Christy.
What?
While in custody for the breaking and entering and larceny, Owens admitted he had destroyed the bodies of JT and Christy at his property. Detectives got a search warrant for Owens' home, and it was there in the wood stove that they found human remains nearly completely cremated by that point. The remains were sent to the Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center to be analyzed, but unfortunately, there wasn't much left. Almost a year went by with no identification, so the remains were sent to an FBI lab for further testing. After the discovery of the remains, Owens was charged with murder. During an interview with detectives on March 16th, and this information is coming from the Asheville Citizen Times, Owens waived his right to an attorney and admitted to the killings, but said it had been an accident. He said he was behind the wheel of JT's truck when it got stuck in a ditch, and JT and Christy were standing in front of the truck trying to help get it unstuck when Owens accidentally hit the accelerator running over them. So now he's saying Christy was there, too, despite not mentioning her to his wife when he told her this story.
Nope.
Owens then said, and this is a quote, "Then I backed over them because I knew what I had done." So these are your friends, you claim. You accidentally, quote unquote, hit them, you claim. You know that Christy is pregnant. You don't get out to see if they're okay. You don't call an ambulance right then and there.
It's messed up.
You just think, huh, I think I just killed them. Better make sure. Let me run over them again. I don't believe this is what happened, but we'll probably never know the truth of exactly what happened.
Damn.
Another reason his story falls apart for me is because Christy was 5 months pregnant with her first child. I don't believe for 1 second that she would be out there trying to help push a truck out of a ditch.
Nope.
The amount of force that would require would be so risky for her and her baby, and she would know that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, investigators found no damage to JT's truck. However, they did learn that Owens and a friend had recently cleaned the back of his truck.
Mm-hmm.
But Owens continued his story, saying that after he ran over them, he took Christy's body into the house and put her in her bedroom. Then he took JT's body to his home, where he used an electric reciprocating saw to dismember him before placing his remains in a plastic bag. Then Owens went back to the Cods, placed Christy's body in the shower, and dismembered her, put her remains in a bag, and brought them over to his property. He then burned both of them in his wood stove. That part we know to be true because detectives did find the remains in the stove.
Yes.
He said he'd burned them to hide what happened because he was worried he'd face manslaughter charges at the very least due to his previous record involving drunk driving and all those other charges like the prescription drugs, etc. He told police, quote, "I'm not a bad guy. I didn't mean to hurt them. They were my friends." Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. If I had friends like that, I would not want enemies.
No.
4 days after he was arrested, a mysterious fire broke out on Owens' property, completely destroying an unoccupied mobile home that sat about 50 yards from his primary residence. Arson investigators were called to the scene, but Sheriff Van Duncan declined to comment on whether the fire was related to the case, if the wood stove had been in that mobile home, or if any evidence had been lost because of the fire. And they weren't able to determine if it had been set by someone trying to destroy evidence, mm-hmm. like a friend of Owens, perhaps,
right.
or if it was someone seeking revenge on Owens.
Oh.
So they couldn't really get a lot from that. In addition to killing his friends and burning their bodies, Owens did sell some of the items he stole from them. Among them were bullets and a grill. He sold items to two different pawn shops as well as a flea market, and then he used that money to fill his truck up with gas and take his wife out to Cheddar's restaurant. Can you imagine being his wife and learning that that Monte Cristo sandwich you're chowing down on was purchased with money he made off items he stole from people he murdered?
Yuck.
Owen said he pawned the items to make it look like it had been a robbery. I'm going to read you a bit of what is in the robbery indictments because I want to see if you understand them the way that I do.
Yeah.
Again, this is from the Asheville Citizen Times.
Okay.
The robbery indictments allege Owens robbed the Codds by means of an assault consisting of having in possession and threatening the use of a dangerous weapon, to wit, a kitchen knife, approximately 10 inches in length with a 6-inch blade and a 4-inch black handle, and or a motor vehicle, and or a firearm, and that Owens broke into the Codds' home, robbed J.T. Codd of a tan and black backpack and its contents, and Christy Codd of a laptop computer, jewelry, and a Glock handgun. The robberies were made from the person and presence of the victims. To me, that's saying he robbed them before he killed them. But yeah. Maybe I'm misinterpreting that.
No, I think you're right.
So I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
Todd Williams, the Buncombe County District Attorney, gave notice that he intended to seek the death penalty, but instead both sides reached a plea deal, which Christy and JT's family approved.
Okay.
Some members of the community were outraged because they felt like Owen should have to go through a trial and face a jury, but I do think the plea deal was the best option in this case.
Okay.
For one, it meant the family didn't have to be dragged through a trial and hear all the stuff that was going to be said.
Yeah.
And it was good for the prosecution because Owens had destroyed a lot of evidence, so they were going to have some challenges proving their case. Williams, that district attorney, said, quote, "Because there are no surviving witnesses and Jason Owens had exclusive control of the crime scene for several days, at least 72 hours, and he had nearly completed the gruesome project of cremating his victims' remains, we will never know many of the facts surrounding the Codds' deaths." Jason Owens agreed to plead guilty to 3 counts of second-degree murder, one for Christy, one for JT, and one for their unborn daughter, Skylar, and 2 counts of dismembering human remains.
Mm-hmm.
The 2 counts of robbery with a dangerous weapon were dismissed as part of the plea deal. During the 2-hour hearing, which took place on April 27th, 2017, Owens' attorney stated that at the time of the crime, he was on painkillers and mentally and psychologically impaired, which caused a lack of rational judgment, but that he accepts responsibility for his actions. They also said he had been diagnosed with PTSD in 2000 after being considered a suspect in the disappearance of his, quote, close friend, Zeb Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird that his close friends keep going missing or getting murdered.
You think.
Williams stated that the murders were among the most disturbing killings in Buncombe County history.
Yikes.
Jason Owens, who was 37 at the time of the hearing, was sentenced to a minimum of 59 and a half years to a maximum of 74 and a half years in prison without the possibility of parole. So effectively, he got a life sentence. The plea deal just took the death penalty off the table.
Yeah.
To circle back to the Zeb Quinn case, authorities felt they had a chance of getting information out of Owens now that he was in custody for the Codd murders. Owens told investigators that he actually did know something about that case, but that he wasn't the one responsible. He said he watched his uncle shoot and kill Zeb because of some bizarre love triangle, then watched his uncle dismember and burn Zeb's remains.
There you go.
The problem with his story is that he kept changing it. There were so many inconsistencies, because now he's saying he'd been tricked by his uncle to lure Zeb to the forest to meet this girl. But originally, back in 2000, he had said that Zeb wanted to buy a new car and he knew one for sale. Very different scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
Investigators were not able to corroborate his story. They went to the area where Owens claimed his uncle had burned Zeb's remains. They found nothing. Also, so many years had passed by this point, so it made finding any evidence that much more difficult.
Yes.
Jason Owens was charged with the murder of Zeb Quinn in 2017. He continued to blame it on his uncle, who actually died in 2017, which was really convenient for Jason.
Definitely.
Even on the uncle's deathbed, he denied having any involvement in the Zeb Quinn case. It was something that had always bothered him.
Yeah.
It bothered him that Jason dragged his name through the mud.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he is actively dying, he insisted, "I had nothing to do with that."
Okay.
On July 25th, 2022, Owens took yet another plea deal, this one for the Zeb Quinn case. pleading guilty to a much lesser charge of being an accessory after the fact to murder. He was sentenced to just 150 to 189 months in prison to be served concurrently with his sentence for the Codd case. There's a great series on YouTube, I mentioned it at the beginning, by WLOS News 13. Again, that's a station local to Asheville. Mm-hmm. The series is called A Good Kid. If you want to know more about the Zeb Quinn case, definitely check that out. I'll link the episode that pertains to the Codd case, and that'll get you to the other episodes.
Got it.
Also, check out the articles in the Asheville Citizen Times. I'm going to link a few. I'm only giving you the bullet points on the Zeb Quinn case to point out similarities to the Codd murders, but that newspaper and the YouTube series have a lot of information about it. Christy Schoen Codd was 38 at the time of her death. Her husband, JT, was 45. Julie Helton, a friend of the couple and a co-worker of JT, she had worked with JT for years on shows like Melrose Place and Without a Trace. She said of Christy, quote, "She was an amazing, amazing, lovely woman. She was a phenomenal cook, and she always invited people over to have dinner and taste some good Southern food. She made some of the most amazing birthday cakes, and her laugh was contagious." Of JT, she said, quote, "No matter how hard the work was or how long the hours were, he was always in a good mood, always there to help people do what they had to do, just an all-around good human being. The two of them together were just so happy and loving." And that is the case of the Codd family murders.
Ugh, that's tragic.
Horrible. And the thing that is interesting is in so many interviews from people, they say over and over that Jason Owens was a great worker, really quiet, really pleasant.
Yeah.
It's so creepy. I mean, I kind of did a deep dive into her Facebook and found those videos. And it's really creepy to see the two of them talking.
Yeah.
And he does just seem like this, you know, quiet, I'm just here to do my job.
Weird. Something else is going on.
There's something. I mean, this is me speculating, but I do think he had something to do with the $5,000 of tools being stolen.
Yes, 100%.
Even if he didn't do it himself, I think maybe he might have alerted someone to be like, hey.
Absolutely.
Who knows? But other people around town, because businesses had hired him and stuff to like do jobs, they all said that he did great work.
Something happened.
He had so many run-ins with the law. Right. This wasn't like a new thing suddenly.
No.
With the Zeb Quinn thing, because that does seem to be the first major situation, I have a feeling he knew Zeb had saved up a bunch of money, you know, for this new car. And me speculating is that either an accident occurred and he didn't know what to do and he freaked out and so he covered it up, or he robbed Zeb, something went down, and Zeb ended up killed. Don't know.
Right.
And unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever know.
Ugh.
There are some letters that he wrote that have been posted online, like the Buncombe County office posted them on X, actually.
Oh, wow.
And they're handwritten letters. And I read through them, and he doesn't accept any real responsibility of anything. And the thing is, like, he was married and he had two girls of his own.
Yikes.
It's just awful, no matter how you
it's
look
terrible.
At it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is the case.
Damn.
You can let us know what you thought about it on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube at
Horrorwood Podcast.
Send us an email at
horrorwoodpodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can be like Josie and hop on over to Patreon and sign up on the Patreon at
patreon.com/horrorwoodpodcast.
Bye, everybody. See you next time.